Thank you, Baruch. Thank you, Simon. And thank you above all, Andre, for joining us from New York. And congratulations on yet another translation of Out of Egypt. To introduce you very, very briefly to an audience that probably already knows your work, besides Out of Egypt, which we'll talk about today, Andre is the best-selling author of books like False Papers, Enigma, Variations, Eight White Nights, Harvard Square, and many others. In 2007, Andre released his debut novel, The Desire Drenched Call Me By Your Name, which has been adapted into an Oscar-winning film, and last October published its much-anticipated sequel, Find Me. I think both of those novels, which reflect on how love sort of bends and warps over time, have already appeared in Russian translation. Andrei received his PhD from Harvard in comparative literature and subsequently taught at Princeton and at Bard College. And he currently teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's also the editor of the Proust Project. And as we'll talk about now, I think throughout his fiction and nonfiction both, Andrei has maintained a very profound preoccupation with memory and with the themes of exile and homecoming. And in my opinion, he knows what to say, but also what to leave unsaid. And what he does say, he says with a profound sense of irony. So welcome, Andrei. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And welcome, all of you. I'm really very grateful for this moment. I seldom speak to a Russian audience, so this is particularly gratifying.
Andrei, I thought maybe we could just start how this book, Out of Egypt, came to be, when and how did you resolve to write it? I remember you telling me once that you were at the time, I think, teaching at Princeton, and it was either this book or a book about how to quit smoking.
It's true. It was even before I got a job at Princeton. I was interested in I used to teach a class of how to quit smoking in a publishing house, and I became friendly with the chief editor there, and we had lunch one day, and I said, "You know, I'd like to write a book about, quitting smoking." And he says, "Oh, that's a great idea. And yeah, we can help you for that. Yeah." And then I said, "But I have another project. It's about growing up as a Jewish boy in Egypt." He says, "Write that and don't tell anyone because I want to see the manuscript first." Of course, I didn't show him the manuscript first, but the book did very well and it's still being available in, I think, around the world.
And at that time, when you were writing Out of Egypt, were you also sort of thinking about an academic career, about academic writing? Was that too stifling at the time?
No, I was thinking and hoping for an academic career. I was significantly younger, and I was nervous because I knew that an academy would want me to write scholarly works. And I had finished a dissertation. I was going to turn that into a book, but I really didn't want to write scholarship. I wanted to write what was in my head, in my heart, in my guts. And I was not really committed to the academy. I was a good teacher, and I'm still in touch with many students from Princeton, which adds, about 20 years ago. But I'm happy with the career that I really wanted. This is what I wanted. I wanted to write essays. I wanted to write reviews. I wanted to write fiction.
Maybe you could sort of usher us into the story by telling us a little bit about your own family's ancestry. I mean, in a sense, you've had an inheritance of exile, right? I mean, your family originally, I think, came from Spain and then to Italy and from Italy to Turkey, and maybe culturally felt not exactly at home in any of those places.
Yes, and in fact, that's what you inherit in the end. It's you inherit the fundamental dislocation where, in other words, you don't belong anywhere and you try to make a home somewhere. And you have children and grandchildren and great grandchildren, and it is your home now, but it's never your home because you don't feel that this is terra firma under your feet. You always suspect that maybe you're going to lose everything. You might get kicked out or you might get killed for being Jewish. So there was always this thing hanging on our heads. I think my father's business was very prosperous. He was doing very well. And at the same time, He was not happy in Egypt. He didn't feel secure. And he stayed for as long as he could. He probably would have wanted to die there because he lived a good life, even after losing all his assets. But I didn't want to be there, and I wanted to be away. And the moment I went away, I began looking back at Egypt as if it was heaven, which I knew it wasn't. And I still know it was no heaven for a Jew.
Where were your parents born?
My mother was born in Egypt, but her parents came from Turkey. And my father was born in Turkey because that's where the family had settled for about, I would say, what, 500 years or so. Well, that's the story. Because when I had myself tested for Ancestry.com for my DNA, they said that I had Spanish blood in me, but 1% of it was Spanish. So the rest was everywhere else but Spain. So I know that I grew up in a family where everybody spoke Ladino, which is Spanish for Jews. And but obviously there's only 1% of me that is Spanish. Yet again, I feel as if I've been thrown out of my own security, which was at least Spain was secure. Well, it wasn't. It turned out to be a myth as well.
On the one hand, you write about Alexandria in this book in a very beguiling way as a kind of polyglot city of many languages. You went to school, you write, with kids who spoke Italian and English and French and Greek and, of course, Arabic, and there were Muslims and Copts. And on the other hand, maybe you can share us sort of the dark underside of that polyglot experience. I mean, were you the only Jew in class? Was it difficult to have that kind of childhood?
It was exceptionally difficult because in my class, I was the only Jew, but I was white-skinned, and the only other white-skinned, I mean, totally white-skinned kids were, you know, Catholics or Greek Orthodox. And it became problematic for me because every time the teacher would mention Israel, everybody in the class, and there was about, you know, almost 25, maybe 30 kids in the class, they would all turn towards me and basically look at me as if I was an Israeli, which I wasn't, but I was Jewish, and for them, there was no difference, and it's fine. But one of the things that I like to joke about, but it wasn't funny at the time, was that in swimming class, I was always claiming to have a cold because I didn't want to undress in front of everybody because they would have seen that I had a different kind of penis than most other white-skinned boys, and they would have gathered, they're not stupid, they would have gathered, okay, he's not Muslim, therefore he has to be Jewish. And so I was constantly hiding the penis.
Do you know how to swim today?
Yes, I'm a good swimmer. I learned to swim in a girls' school in Egypt.
Much better. Yeah,
there was no question that I was going to undress in front of the girls.
So you left Egypt in 1965 with your family, and then you came back 30 years later. What was it like to come back to Alexandria after three decades? Was there a kind of thrill of recognition in that experience?
Well, you have a thrill of recognition if you've forgotten things. Suddenly you rediscover them. You know, it's like the Madeleine brings you back to your special privileged moment in your childhood. There was nothing to recognize. The city was very much the same. I took long walks, hoping to get lost, but I was never lost. I knew everything. There were new buildings, and old buildings had disappeared. Old, wonderful villas had entirely disappeared, and they keep disappearing today. But I was not, there was no recognition. There was nothing that was that made me elated by the recognition. It was just old Alexander. So as soon as I got to the hotel and I had taken a walk, I called my father in New York, and I said, you know, I'm in Alexandria. I'm right above the famous, pastry shop. And he said, oh, how is it? How is Alexandria? How is it? I said, Dad, it's Alexandria. It hasn't changed. It's the same thing. But the one thing I did recognize that was very sobering was that as I kept walking in the street, I felt that many eyes were turned on me. And I realized soon enough why. Because the French, the English, the Italian, the Greek, the whole sort of foreign population had left. They had disappeared. So it was an Egyptian city, which by all means it should have been because it is in Egypt, but the whole foreign population, which was my base, my life, my society, if you want, had entirely disappeared. So I felt totally not at home. If I didn't feel at home before, now I was completely a stranger. I was a New Yorker walking in Alexandria.
Speaking of New York, one of my favorite passages in this book is when you're in Egypt and you describe being overcome really by a sudden yearning precisely for New York of all places and for West End Avenue in particular. And you write as follows. You say, "I was in Alexandria, homesick for a place from which I learned to recreate Alexandria, the way the rabbis in exile were forced to reinvent their homeland in paper, only to find that perhaps they worship the paper more than the homeland." I love that passage. And I wonder if you can say something more about that and say maybe whether you found that you enjoyed writing about Alexandria or longing for Alexandria more than you enjoyed Alexandria itself.
I think you've got it nailed perfectly. I think that in order to write anything, even if you're going to write about a horrible occurrence in your life, at some point the writing process is seductive enough and makes you fall in love with the subject that you're writing about. You cannot write anything without falling in love with what you're writing. I mean, you might have doubts about its quality, you may feel insecure or whatever, but as you're writing, you are the piece of paper you're writing. And I think for many writers, writing is really the fundamental home. Everything else can be transient because you basically put your very best in a piece of paper. This does not contain family because family is special and I will throw all my books if anything happened to my family. But the essence of that nostalgia is weird because in New York, I thought I was reliving by passing by a falafel store. I was passing by a falafel store and I smelled Alexandria and I felt very homesick suddenly. And then when I was in Alexandria, I passed by many falafel places, but they all reminded me of that one in New York City. And I suddenly felt homesick for New York City. So I said, there is something very wrong here. It's basically, you don't like where you are. You always want to be, as the word in Hebrew is, across the river, to be somewhere else. You want to be elsewhere. So the elsewhere is something that I carry in me. And I play with that and I develop it. I sort of cut it up and put it together every single time I write anything because that is my home. Paper is my home. On the other hand, I'm smart enough to know that paper is not a home, which is why I named one of my books False Papers and another book called Alibis. In other words, paper is not going to ground you on earth any more than having a passport. So you are always, in a sense, rudderless. You have no keel. You have no sense of where you belong. And that stays.
It reminds me of an essay by George Steiner called My Homeland, the Text.
Yeah. Well, is it an extraterritorial, I think?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good book. Smart man.
In this book, you have one of the characters say, as Jews, you lose everything at least twice in your life. What did you mean by that? Is this related to what you just said?
It is related. Of course, it sounds fantastic and it sounds very profound, but I made it up. But it means fundamentally that a Jew doesn't lose everything once in their life. They lose it twice, many times over. If I think of my father, he was born in Turkey, but he had to leave Turkey. He moved to Egypt. From Egypt, he moved to France. From France, he moved to the United States. And each time he thought it was going to be his home, and it was not. So in each time, he lost everything that he owned and kept losing more and more and more. So it makes sense And it sounds profound. I don't know that it's true of all Jews. Many Jews feel rather secure in their lives. I think most American Jews feel they are Americans. There's nothing, no problem. There are no threats. I don't think that a real Jew feels that there are no threats. It is always there. You may not want to know it. You may not see it. But it's hovering, and your grandparent will remind you, if you forgot, that it's never stable.
I was thinking that what you just said, you mentioned earlier that the very etymology of the word Ivri, of Hebrew, is he who stands on the other side. And I was thinking, as you were talking about this contrast, really, between, you have the figure of Abraham, the original someone from the other side, the original Hebrew, but then you have a figure who comes up in a strange way in this book, Odysseus, because you, I think, attribute a poem to Cavafy about Odysseus. I think Cavafy never wrote such a poem, but it just shows your skill as a poetic inventor. And I was thinking that there's a great contrast in your book between the Abraham Hebraic theme and the Odysseus Greek theme, just on the obvious level, which is that Abraham never returns to his birthplace. Odysseus does.
Yes, but in my Odysseus, he's basically told by, I think it's Circe, don't waste your time going back home. You know, you've invented your home. The home that you want no longer exists, and it's changed over 20 years. So don't waste your time. Stay with me. And Odysseus is very, very tempted to stay. He doesn't make a decision in my poem, but he is basically, this is an alternative. Maybe I should stay here. On the other hand, the Jew is always on the other side. And I think that's a theme that I've carried over in most of my books, and particularly in the one that's coming out very shortly, where you're always on one bank of the river, but the best part of you, the one that means the most to you, is on the other bank. So you want to at least hope that the two coincide, and they never will. So there's a part of you that is, as in one of my novels, I call it, it's called Eight White Nights, and very inspired by a Russian writer. But it is, the idea is that you are in a part of Lake Como, and across the lake there is Bellagio, which is, it's night, at nighttime, it's light eye flickering. Bellagio is the most perfect spot on earth. And you just want to cross a little nothing piece of water to get to Bellagio. But it's on the other bank. You will never go there. Your best life is there.
I wonder if we can tie some of this together by proposing that the exile, or someone who has experienced exile, has trouble with the present tense. You've written a collection of essays on the conditional and subjunctive moods. And I wanted to ask, why are these moods important to you? As grammatical moods, as opposed to the present tense?
Well, first of all, I think that regardless of what everyone claims, we're never in the present tense. I'm going to say, I'm in the here and now, I belong to the present tense. You don't. Your fantasies, if you are able to acknowledge that you have fantasies all the time, drift either into the past or into the future. But the one tense that I find particularly relevant to me is the conditional mood, and also the subjunctive. In other words, those are tenses that belong to a whole class of moods. They're moods. They belong to a whole class of moods that are known as the irrealis mood. And basically, they are about what might have happened but never happened, though you wished it had happened and might still happen, though at the same time you fear that it might happen. So in this conflux of all these moods of might have beens and might not have beens, I think most of us live in that particular zone, though we don't like to claim it because then we'll be crazy and they'll put us away. But in fact, this is the mood that I find most relevant to my life. Most of my books do not end with, this is what we did at that particular night. It's, this is what I hoped might happen once I would have done blah, blah, blah. And this is exactly how I end all my books, in the conditional mode, because there's something very, I find, very banal about giving you closure. I don't believe there is closure. In fact, my favorite past tense is the imperfect tense, because it's never over. It goes on forever. So in many ways, I don't think that anything stops in life. Your first love in your life continues to resonate throughout the rest of your life. The first mistake you made in your life, you will repeat it in many ways for the rest of your life. You can go to every therapist on planet Earth. You will not correct yourself. And that I do believe that, in other words, that there are things that are in us that do not have any business to do with the indicative mood, the present tense, the here and now. We're never in the here and now. I certainly am not. And I've made basically a career out of showing to people that when they're in love with what might happen, not with the other person necessarily.
Would you say that you give to many of your characters, you present them with impediments for, you know, conclusion, you give them a sense of deferral, you make it hard for them to come home? Is that part of this subjunctive?
Well, I will explain what you just began by saying. Let me go back to Call Me By Your Name, which has a very clear example. I started the book because I wanted to be in Italy. So I created this fantasy of being in a house in Italy, etc. Then I decided I'm going to write fiction with that house. And I'm going to put a man or a young man and a young girl in that book. And then I decided, started writing it this way. It was going okay until I realized there is a problem. They will have sex immediately. And that's not where the drama is. I wanted them to be inhibited, to be ashamed, to be reluctant, to be undecided, to be afraid, because this is what we all feel before we pick up the telephone or text someone that we are attracted to. We are scared, we're unresolved or irresolute. And I found that writing about a character who was inhibited was far more interesting from a psychological point of view than about somebody who is desiring a person and then goes to bed with them, and then goes to bed with somebody else, and so on. That I found that there was no combat, at least no internal combat. But once I decided to write about two men, then there was clearly, I had a green light to write about deferral and reluctance and shame and inhibition and all those emotions that I know very well.
And was it a very different experience to write Call Me By Your Name as contrasted with writing Out of Egypt? Obviously, some of these themes that we've been talking about today are common, but was it a different experience? I think you had told me earlier that Call Me By Your Name came to you quite quickly, and Out of Egypt was more labor-intensive.
It was more labor. Out of Egypt was a more labored book I wrote it in, I think, about a year and a few months. But I wrote Out of Egypt because, in the way I did, because I had to remember things. I had to basically decide how to make these characters who are fundamentally tragic and displaced people, how to make them alive and how to realize that to me, they were completely ridiculous. And in others, the only way for me to accept who they were was to realize the first thing about them, that they were ridiculous or crazy or mildly out of the ordinary. And this is the kind of family that I come from. It's true. But they were snobs. At the same time, they were sometimes acting as if they were extremely poor. My grandmother used to eat yogurt and toasted bread at night. Because it was cheap or because it was healthy, because she didn't want to spend what she spent on lunches, which were always very lavish. So there was a kind of economy and at the same time showmanship. And I loved all those many, many contrasts that existed in my family. And so I had to display them in a way that gave them a story, because you need a chronicle as well. And you also have to have a style that accompanies this this story. And the one person that influenced me tremendously, because when I realized that she could do it, I can certainly do it, was Natalia Ginzburg, the Italian writer who wrote about her family and especially about her father, making him into a ridiculous character. And so once I could make everybody in my family ridiculous, the pen went fast. My teachers were all ridiculous. In fact, if I could kill them, now they're all dead, but if I could kill them, I would do it. They were very, very evil people and stupid beyond belief. So yes, I took my revenge on them.
Were there other senses in which your writing has been an act of taking revenge?
No, because most of my characters eventually, I found this because somebody asked me a question one day, was my characters tend to be good people. So they may be evil in certain moments, but basically they're good people. And I love, after I've undressed them and exposed them, I love pulling up their pants and telling them, okay, you got your dignity back. Go back now. Go to live your life as you want. I take my revenge in points, and then I finally redeem you because I have to. I can't live with myself if I've just sent you to hell for perpetuity. I'm not Dante.
I was thinking of some of the things that tie together out of Egypt with your novels and with Call Me By Your Name and Find Me. And I was thinking that one of the threads is this something else that you cite, which is the great speech of Aristophanes in Plato's Symposium, where he tells the story of how humans were originally sort of two people conjoined, which by the way has great echoes in Midrash, and that this form was so powerful and so threatened the gods that Zeus had to cleave us apart. And therefore, in a sense, love is also about exile from one another. So exile, we've been talking about, of course, in the national sense, but exile in your fiction is also deeply individual.
It's the same thing. It is exactly the same thing. In other words, there is a sense that the other person is really you. The other person is not a stranger. It's you. You in a different guise. And the most perfect unions are between two people who are not opposites of each other, but fundamentally identical, that who can read each other's minds beautifully, who have no shame because your shame is already mine because I've experienced the same thing. It is, in fact, what Call Me By Your Name means. It means I have become you and you have become me. Mm-hmm. The caveat in Aristophanes or in the Symposium is that if we don't behave, then the gods will cut us again in two. And then what will happen? We'll be hopping on one leg, which is not fun. But it's what I was saying earlier about the other bank on across the river. Our other half is across the river. And we want to coincide with it. And we try desperately. And sometimes we seldom succeed, but sometimes we do succeed. And that's what living is all about. It's about finding your other half that is like you, that is you. Of course, the other half has many differences, which is a good thing, because if you are totally identical, then there is no conversation. There's no discussion. There's no disagreement. That doesn't work either.
You remind me that in one of his essays, Bruno Schulz, the Polish-Jewish writer, describes a legend, you might call it sort of the Jewish equivalent of Aristophanes' speech, in which he wants to speak about the exile inherent in language itself and how words seek another, not just people seeking another, but words seeking another. And he says, in this original legend, there was a great serpent, and the serpent was sort of sliced into many pieces. This is the serpent of language. Mm-hmm. This is the original pre-Tower of Babel language. And ever since then, when two words find one another and come to a union in just the right sort of way, then poetry happens. And I thought that's a very beautiful way of also expanding how we think of exile. You're speaking about it in a national term, in your memoir. You speak about it in terms of love deferred in your fiction. But there's also a sense in which exile is inherent in language itself, in which words and sentences seek each other.
Yeah, I think it's totally correct. And if one is a good writer, then one is always aware that there are bad combinations of words. Those are called cliches, and you have to avoid them, because basically what they do is they force your thinking into paths that are not necessarily those that you intended, but seem quite easy, and then you go for it. But I think a writer who thinks about language realizes that every single emotion or every state of being that a writer wants to capture needs to reinvent the language he's writing in or she's writing in. In other words, you have to cobble together words that will sound well together. They can't jar with each other. They might even have a syllabic count which will allow them to rise above ordinary language. And without being poetry, they can nevertheless attain the perfection of poetry, which is, I have said it in such a way that you cannot undo it, and nobody else is going to say it in any other way after this. I have calked it, I have formalized it and put it in stone. And I think that a good writer, I'm thinking of Flaubert, for example, who basically quarreled with the French language until it gave him what he wanted. And if it took days and nights, so much. That's the price you pay. But in the end, the language, the rhythm, the cadence, everything works well together. So that in language, you can create a universe that holds things that your subconscious doesn't know, but that you create. You create, as I like to tell some of my students, I say, in language, you know you're doing something right when from nothing, you have created something. In other words, you came up with an idea as you were writing, because before you were writing, it didn't exist.
And there's something, if I can say so, serpentine about your sentences too, some of which I don't envy actually your Russian translator or any other translator, because some of your sentences, you know, can run to a page or more.
Yes, because a sentiment or an idea, although I don't think I write with ideas in mind, but sometimes what you're describing, if you break it up and chop it up into simpler sentences, what you're doing is you're ruining the insight that is inherent in that sentence. You want that sentence to basically capture you, and ultimately, and I think that is the goal of every writer, is you want your sentences to be spacious enough so that you can allow the reader to slip inside. And once the reader has slipped into your sentence, they have become you. And for them,
do you often have the experience of readers reaching out to you and saying about either your fiction or your nonfiction, it seemed that you were writing exactly about me?
All the time. They write to me every day and they say, you've written me. I didn't know this about myself until I read your book. And what they don't know is that they read my book because I made sure that they, by the style of the sentences, which are sometimes simple, but I wanted them to fall prey to the sensibility that I was offering them. And the only way for them to be sort of, to be inducted into that sentence was to allow them space to do that. Once they're captured by the rhythm, forget the meaning, just the rhythm of the sentence. If they allow themselves to flow into the rhythm, then they have in fact become me and allowed me to become them.
They can call you by their own names.
Yes, they can. They're welcome to. People do that all the time too.
Maybe a couple of last questions. I wanted to ask first, which writers working today do you admire?
That's a difficult question, because I seldom read a lot of contemporary fiction. I think my sensibility is out of sync with not even with the past or with the present, but it's out of sync. I don't find that many other writers are saying what I want to hear. And if they probably have a fantastic story to tell, but I don't find them particularly engaging with my sensibility. The last person, and I may have told you this at some other time, the last person who I felt was really in sync with me, or that I was in sync with him, was W.G. Sebald, the German writer who lived in England all his life, also displaced, who understood that the markers of time sort of are lodged in us all the time, and that they never release us. And even when we die, they continue to hover over our lives and over those who have gone to know us. And this is a subject of my last book, Find Me, where something that happens to someone is passed on to someone else. Not with any mystical meaning, but in other words, there are things that we inherit without wanting to, and we need to do, we need to resolve it if we can.
It's like William Faulkner's famous phrase that the past is not dead, it's not even the past.
Yes, it's totally true. As another writer said, Hartley says, they do things differently in the past. Mm-hmm. And I love that too. Mm.
My last question before we open it up a little bit is also quite general. What are you working on next, if we can speak in the conditional mood?
I'm working on something that I've decided. It's on three novellas, and one has just come out this week, an Audible. It's only going to be published by Audible, at least initially. And it's magical realism, which is a genre that I have no patience for magical realism, and yet here I am writing a magical realism story. The second one is equally something I've never done. It's written entirely from the point of view of a woman. And people will tell me, how do you know this? I said, because, you know, I have whatever it is that I have, I can do it, and it works. And the third one is about something I said was absolutely not going to interest me. Because people always ask me, why do you always have a younger person with an older person? So I usually answer this, do you want two old people to meet and talk about their grandchildren? So I make fun of them. So I decided to write a story about two people who are past retirement age and who get to like each other. So I'm doing three very unusual things for me, but I wanted to do it and to try it.
Sounds like you've been seized by the spirit of experimentation a bit.
For the time being. Then I'm going back to what I do best. I know how to do. I think I know how to do.
Well, with that, I just want to thank you, Andre, for coming and sharing some of your wisdom. And I hope the Russian readers will be as moved by your memoir as the rest of us have had the privilege of being. And I want to thank Eshkolot and Simon in particular for bringing us together from New York and Jerusalem respectively and beaming us into Moscow in this way. And thank you all for joining us this evening.
I have to thank all of you truly, because this has been in the works for quite a while, has it not? And I think it's wonderful. And Benjamin, especially, is this the second time you do this? You can never do it a third time. It's enough already. But I wish you all the best on your book on Bruno Schultz,
who is
the writer that I absolutely adored. I had no idea how much I would love him when somebody mentioned his name. And because it was somebody intelligent, I just went and got the book. Then I got the second book. And then I got very interested in the whole world that he belonged to. And good luck with this. This is going to be good. It's going to be great. I'm sure it is. Thank you, Simon. And Eshkolot, of course, thank you so much. And thank you for my friend, especially, who's from Facebook, Anastasia. Thank you so much for being here. I truly appreciate it.